Orhan Bey, thank you very much. Welcome to Los Angeles. And congratulations on yet another marvelous, enchanting book.
Thank you.
The Museum of Innocence, this book actually, it took about a decade or so to complete, didn't it? In fact, I remember...
But writing of it was five years. In the end, I write just imitating like so many authors, James Joyce. It's James Joyce who wrote after he, at the end of Ulysses, as if it's a painting that he wrote the years that it make that he spent writing it. So this I wrote between 2001 and 2002, then from 2003 to 2008. In between 2002 and 2000, I wrote Istanbul. Mm-hmm. So I gave this book 5.5 years.
Yes, in fact, there's a wonderful scene in your novel Snow when the fictional Orhan Pamuk admits to the protagonist that he's working on a book called The Museum of Innocence.
Yes, I thought of the book 10 years ago. I began thinking about the whole project. The idea of the book was in my mind 11 years ago. When I finished My Name is Red, I remember asking myself whether now I should write this book, and I also had what now later ended being called Snow. Shall I write this political novel or this Museum of Innocence? They were both in my mind. I took notes for both of them, but I realized that this is more complicated. I had to prepare myself, so I think thinking that it will be easier to write Snow, begin writing Snow, and then delayed this.
Well, what is it about this that makes it so much more complicated? It is a much broader story.
I think I had the energy to write about political things. There was the rise of political Islam that was attractive. Mm-hmm. I already had written a political novel in late 70s, at some 200 pages. Then there was a military coup in Turkey. And this was about my leftist friends, not a propaganda novel, but a novel about a generation. But then there was a military coup, and I understood that although the novel was not a propaganda novel, but I would be in trouble if I publish it, so I put that in a drawer. Then, that there was this suppressed desire to write a political novel. But then some 20 years later, the interesting subject was not Cold War or leftism, rightism, but the rise of political Islam. And this time I wanted to write again, almost dramatizing the same humane problems of the country. So this time I began to immediately write Snow, and I thought I would write it fast, and I wrote it fast, relatively fast, I think.
And you mentioned at the beginning of your reading that this is a book about love. Really, all your books are about love. But it's a different kind of love, isn't it? It's a kind of love that I have to say that I think probably most of us in the West are unfamiliar with. You know, our conceptions of love here are more or less defined by Hollywood, whereas in our cultures, love is much more influenced by... the kind of love spoken of by the great Sufi poets, the kind of love that is always unrequited, a self-negating
yes,
love.
Yes, I think, but then, there is, of course, there's so many echoes of Turkish melodramas, which are based on, say, Leyla in Mecnun, or old medieval Islamic romances, but then medieval Islamic romances and medieval Christian romances are more or less the same, that... a culture, I would simplify it and say that love in a suppressed culture where the lovers cannot meet easily, isn't it like that in Romeo and Juliet too, that they cannot easily negotiate, easily meet, there are no parties, there is almost no sex before marriage, outside of marriage. This is the culture. And melodramas or high literary texts take this as granted, and sophistication of lovers, what Roland Barthes would call lovers' discourse, is based on that, where when there is not when the lovers do not meet, but the human heart is the same everywhere. They exchange, negotiate through glances, staring, silences, gestures, test each other's endurance, test so forth and so on.
Yes.
Instead of other things, I mean, how they make love or this or that. Then that is a tradition, whether I approve it or not, whether I found it egalitarian, libertarian, whether I'm critical, it's a secondary. Of course I'm critical of it, but it's a secondary thing. The more I get older, I look at human beings as I don't want to judge them, pass ethical judgment on my characters, but try to see and represent my characters, human beings, who are victims of the given society, whether we are in West, whether we are in Istanbul, whether we are in China. We are, more or less, human beings are, optimistically, humanistic way, believe we are all alike, but we sort out our problems in a given conditions, given traditions. Mm. We don't care much about conditions and traditions. Maybe we don't respect that, but of course we want to live a happy life, and we sort of search for happiness in given rules, conditions. When there is sex before marriage is a taboo, virginity is a taboo, when the girl and the boy cannot meet in high school parties or college parties or office parties, when lovers' negotiations and discourse is highly suppressed, even upper classes, as I here suggest, then lovers develop and find a fine language, a sophisticated language, and everyone is capable of sophisticated language in different way, in mm-hmm. looking at each other, in their silences, in moving their eyebrows, or even saying double meanings and this or that. This book pays attention to that. These themes are subject of Turkish melodramas or classical allegories of Leyla and Mecnun. But then this is a novel, and I'm doing this in a modern novel's frame and in tongue-in-cheek, in an ironic way.
You brought up Leyla and Mecnun, which is talked about a lot in the book, the great epic poem by my countryman, Nizami. And of course, in the story, it's this story about these two lovers who can never come together. It's the lover and the beloved, the kind of love that's self-negating. And actually, in a way, I read a lot of this love story as just sort of an allegory of Leyla and Mecnun. I want to read something that Kamal says about Füsun. And this is a theme that comes up over and over again. He says, "I could consider and even feel all that passed through her heart and mind. I could speak through her mouth, understand how she felt a thing, even as she felt it herself, for I was she." That is ultimately the point of Leyla and Mecnun, that the lover and the beloved are one being, but a one being that can never come together.
It's pantheistic vision, and it's also corresponds to various levels that the Sufi, the traveler should go through in the end, realizing that God is in himself, and if it's in a love story, we have to read it as a double meaning text, so forth and so on. But yes, I make all these allusions, but then on the level of a popular novel or a contemporary novel, that also works. I like having these layers, implications, but then when you insist, if you insist, but you're not doing that, then I say, well, yes, but there is a limit to that this is not Leyla and Mecnun. This is a modern love story. Mm-hmm. Of course, well, the culture is a continuation of Leyla and Mecnun, that it's a love, again, as I'm alluding to Garcia Marquez, Love in the Times of Cholera, and then my novel is also that kind of a long novel, and I'm saying this is love in the time, love in a repressed society.
How much is your ideas of love? I mean, you talk about the way that society and culture and tradition define and perhaps even limit mm-hmm. Ideas of love. How much, I wonder, do you think, is it society, and how much is it Is it a psychological, maybe even a Jungian genetic thing about the way that we think about love?
I understand Jung in that there is a continuity of archetypes in all of us, but then it doesn't come with blood or what genes. Jung suggests that we are born with it, so like Kantian categories. I don't believe that. That it's called that cultures have continuity. Then we can also, the continuity is palpable, that boy, it's not easy that boy and girl meet. It's not easy that boy and girl have sex before marriage. These are the given conditions. Mm-hmm. Even the upper classes of Istanbul, what I sometimes refer as high society, with their pretensions of westernization, they, we see, that also troubled by the weight of tradition. Again, here I want to underline the fact that as I get older, I don't want to judge my characters past, oh, upper classes, you were all posing as westernizers or westernize and modern and legitimize your power and wealth, but actually you're no different. Mm-hmm. This is a fact, that's a point I made in the book, but I don't blame my finger to anyone.
The sort of narrative drive of the book is this the protagonist Kamal that you talked about and his love for Fosun, and over the course of many years that the book takes place, the way that Kamal experiences that love is by physically taking her things, used cigarette butts, an ashtray, a Kleenex that she used, a teacup. Mm. And he calls these things, he calls them the tangible, precious debris of the storm raging in my soul. And as Louise mentioned, you in the process of writing this also began to collect these materials.
Yes,
didn't you?
What was
the collection of the material the thrust for the narrative, or was it the other way around?
Look, I'm also doing a museum with the things, the fictional Kemal collected, because I collected them myself to write the novel, because I am doing a museum. It's a physical thing. I had bought a house 10 years ago as I developed the thing. But here, I don't want to talk too much about it. I don't want to legitimize my novel with the museum. Hopefully, I will open it in next summer. Then I would be, if I can successfully open it, establish it, and would feel, get rid of my nervousness about it, then I would be freer to talk about it. Now I have all sorts of anxiety, a lot of regrets about making it, but I will make it. And I don't want to legitimize my novel on that. Yeah, but then it's a double project. Yes, yeah, there is the novel. I was going to say there will be a novel. There is a novel.
There's a novel. It's here.
And then there will be a museum too. But then let's talk about the text now.
Yeah. So I guess that's what I'm saying. but I do indeed mean the museum in the text. I'm not referring to the physical museum. Mm. What I'm saying is that Kamal, he sees the museum itself as sort of he calls it the consolation of the objects.
Yes, that I believe, that this is a Proustian idea, the famous Madeleine, but let's forget Proust, that objects have, the presence of objects have immense power in our memories. Let me give you an example. Say I have been to Los Angeles before and stayed in the same hotel, but before entering the hotel second time, I really remember very few details about where the door is, how the hotel rooms are. But as soon as I entered the hotel, I remember there's a lobby here, there is an elevator there. As soon as I come to the hotel, I remember all the details. We all know this experience. So I would tell you another thing. We just grab in an old jacket, we find on a dress, we find an old forgotten movie ticket. We have already forgotten the fact that we have seen that movie, right? But the ticket not only reminds us that we have seen that movie, but some scenes of the movie come back from the deeper parts of our memory. The Lord, more or less, we sense this sort of experience, we understand this sort of experience. We have this information from our personal experience suggesting that there is a vast memory source deep down in some place in our memory, whatever, hard disk, but it does not easily come up unless we come across an object, a visual thing that reminds or triggers that memory to come up. The consolatory power of objects that my character, Kemal, talks about so much is related to that. Or Proust's Madeleine is related to that. Objects carry, have a power to trigger the association that associations that when we experience or when we are surrounded, when we sense these objects, we feel also so many sentiments. We are unhappy, we are anxious, we are, have expectations, optimistic, we are in love, or we are full of hate, jealousy, this or that. And around us are visions, vistas, objects. Now, second time we see these objects, then all these feelings come back to us. This is an idea that I also developed in my book, Istanbul, saying that if you live in a city too long, then the city's vistas, the urban scapes, had the power to invoke us all the sensations we had experienced when we had walked in the same streets, when we walk in that so-and-so, say, Kazanji Yokuşu in Istanbul, I was angry and so unhappy or what. Then next time I walk in the same street, the street has the capacity to evoke those memories. If you live in the in a city so long as I did 57 years, as I did in Istanbul, then the city converts to a sort of an index of memories. More or less, also, objects turn into a, have the power to be an index of our lives. That's what Kemal is doing. In fact, I argue at the end of the book that museums should have the power to evoke our memories. They should not be places where great powers, be it the state or the rich man or the big company, Coca-Cola, any other state's flag or companies, institution, sign and symbol. It should they should be private places where human memory, our interior lives, our memories, the fragile things that we associated with ourselves should be kept. This is Kemal's argument, and here I'm very close to Kemal.
But what happens then when the objects themselves, I mean, as you say, the objects have to elicit a kind of individual or collective memory. If I walk into a room and I see a black top hat, it means nothing to me. If somebody tells me this hat used to belong to Abraham Lincoln, now it's full of meaning.
Okay, but that is the communal object. You were not wearing that hat. Right. Abraham Lincoln was wearing that. That's something else. That has the communal, national representative power. We have to make that distinction. I'm talking about personal museums. I'm not talking about Louvre. I'm not talking about MoMA or Metropolitan Museum. I'm talking about personal museums which have the imprint of personal lives, which are valuable for me. I'm a novelist. And in fact, at the end of the book, Kemal visits all the personal small museums which are engulfed with an aura of defeat and lost and melancholy because no one goes there. You go there. A person invested his life there. He is not there to show that he is rich and powerful, but there is also a personal side to it. And then that side had failed, that museum guards are sleeping, the parquet is creaking, you're alone. There is a modern life outside, and you're lost in a out-of-time melancholy feeling. I like that. Kemal likes it. This book is a sort of a homage to that kind of feeling, too.
Of course, in many ways, Istanbul, the city of your home, the city that you say defines so much about you, is also a museum.
All cities are. We convert the cities to museums because it's full of our memories. But then the building changes, the trees are fall apart, the streets are the visual aspects of the streets. Buildings change, and we get angry. That's why we get angry and nostalgic and resist a change. We want to keep our memories alive. The index power that I referred to just now of the cities we live in, we want them to continue to evoke our memories. That's a very humane thing. That's also our illusion about the museums are also based on that. We think we go to museums because our memories will be evoked. Actually, most of the time, it's the some companies, some nations, some powers, some governors, some historical persons. Power and flag and sign and symbol and emblem is exhibited there rather than our memories.
Yeah, there's a moment in which Kamal says in the book, he defines museums in the way that you just mentioned. He says they're repositories of those things from which Western civilization derives its wealth and knowledge.
Now, that I also make at the end of the book. I do a bit of a theorizing in a humane way about museums and collections and collectors. There I argue, and again I'm here, I'm as it happens in novels, sometimes the narrator and the novelist may more or less share some opinions. there I argue or suggest that human heart is same everywhere, that in all of us there is an inclination to attach objects. Some people get attached to objects and then later begin to collect them. Even the word collect is wrong here because we get attached and assemble them is the right word. But in Western civilization, where the idea of museum invented, these collections or assembled objects I put on a pedestal and exhibited in a museum and respected because museums are sort of places where human information about world are collected. Behind the museums lie, in 17th century, Wunderkammers, or Cabinet of Curiosities, where European princes and people of power had exhibited, say, ivories, strange minerals, strange animals, curiosities to suggest their power, their finesse, their power to go to foreign lands, so forth and so on. But then these developed into museums, where in non-Western societies, exhibiting collections to show the signs and symbols of the prince or the powerful people do not exist. In fact, a good anecdote about is that. Pierre Loti, the French writer, I don't like him too much, went to Japan and wrote about coming across a Japanese prince, showing him his chest, a chest full of collections, but he was not showing it to public, he was not showing it to friends. Modestly, he was, whatever he had, whatever collection, and he was not calling it a collection, say carpets or silk, or very interesting objects of curiosity in his chest and keeping it only there, not exhibiting that the wealth of so-and-so prince, or and then, of course, he would be get rid of, and it will be wealth of the people of Japan or what. It was just this guy's modest, quote, collection that he only collected for its own value rather than proving his political power or his cultivation.
I wonder, is this what you're referring to when you write in Istanbul about the homes of the bourgeois being museums, the sitting rooms being museums? You even say that your house was a museum.
Yeah, but then I used it in a different context, saying that they were exhibiting things. Yes, maybe not too different. The living rooms or salons of upper class Westernized Istanbul people. Rich Turkish bourgeois has a living room, and it's more than a living room. It's a room where they show vitrines in which signs and symbols of westernization were exhibited. That's what I meant by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say the sitting rooms were little museums designed to demonstrate to hypothetical visitor that the householders were westernized.
Yes.
Yes. Well, to stay with Istanbul for a moment, obviously this is so much a part of who you are as a person, so much a part of who you are as a writer. There's this, you know, in your section in Istanbul where you talk about how some of your favorite writers, like for instance Naipaul, are writers whose imaginations were fed by a sense of exile, whereas in many ways, you're sort of the opposite. Your imagination requires, as you say, that you remain, quote, in the same city, on the same street, in the same house, gazing at the same view.
That's how I lived till almost 55 years. The last 3 or 4 years, I'm traveling a lot. But my life was like that, unfortunately or fortunately. But now in America, the idea of migration, the people coming to this melting pot, is an American invention, essentially, and it's a successful American, America is a successful result of melting pot. This is a country, lots of people immigrated, came from different countries. But, and especially in American academia, I also teach at Columbia University, everyone is talking about hybridity, immigration, mm-hmm. not belonging, as if this is the common fate of humanity. But according to UNESCO statistics, 97% of humanity is still living what they still call home. That is, they did any statistics and asked human beings, so are you living at home? And they say, yes. They may have to change a street or a village, but they are still living in what they call home. Mm-hmm. But in America, and especially in academia, there people are not living what they call home. Say he is an Indian-born, a Calcutta-born professor.
That's right.
He's teaching at Columbia University and propagating the idea of hybridity, moving. Well, mm-hmm. It's only 3%, by the way. 97% live like me in the same street,
yeah.
In the same house, looking at the same view.
Well, but of course, it's not just that you live in Istanbul, and in many ways you've become Istanbul. You say that your fate and the city's fate are one, that you are defined by the city, and yet you talk about the city in these interesting terms. You talk about Istanbul as, quote, an impoverished city buried under the ashes of a ruined empire. Is that how you feel sometimes?
I wrote that in my autobiography where I narrate my childhood that took place in 1950s, 60s, and that is how it felt.
It's different now.
This is different then. My Istanbul, where I make these observations, ends practically in 1973, almost 34 years ago. The mood, the atmosphere changed. This city is much richer and colorful now. Younger generation of Turkish readers and happy tourists reacted to my book saying, well, we've been there, we enjoy it, it's so colorful city, what is this black and white melancholy you find in it? They say there is truth to it, then there is not truth to it. There is truth to it. Most of the time tourists don't understand a city at all. They just go there, enjoy, have lived with their wives and spouses a happy week, happier than their regular life, and go back and say, what a wonderful city it is. It is, but not because they are happy in it. One thing. Another thing is that the city was not like as it is now in 1950s and 60s, and I have to be honest. The observations that I make in Istanbul are not essentialist, all general, eternal observations about the city. Cities change. My brother is an economic historian. In mid-16th century, Istanbul was world's one of the richest places. The payment per human wage per hour was highest in the world in mid-16th century, and Ottoman Empire was then world's greatest empire. Then it probably looked very different as it looked seemed to me. For them, it was not melancholic and black and white to those people who were living there. Probably it was not like that. They felt very self-contained and happy, probably did not care about what other civilizations and other peoples thought, lived a really spiritually different life. We cannot make generalization. Istanbul is like that eternally, and New York is like eternally, Los Angeles is like, we can't say these mm-hmm. things. Our experience, generalization about places and are limited to our own time and experience, of course. I'm sorry, yes.
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say that you've said Istanbul is changing, no doubt it has. Would you say it's become more Western?
No, I would, it's, of course, it had become more Western, but meanwhile, West also become more Western. So there's also they're going to this direction.
But this is actually quite an interesting thing because, you know, part of how you're often defined, and not just you yourself, but some of the authors that you see as you know, authors that have affected you in the way that you write. I'm thinking of Ahmed Hamdi Tanpınar, Yahya Kemal, Reşat Koçu. Mm-hmm. These are writers who write about the tension between East and West in Istanbul. But I wonder, are those terms meaningful? Do they mean anything any
longer?
Look,
these writers do not write about East and West as the journalists ask you. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I'm a sort of a victim of it. I don't want to exaggerate. Hello, Mr. Pamuk, you're writing. And they immediately jump to East. These writers have both had an understanding, their tentacles, their perceptions are open to their glories of Ottoman culture, and also they enjoy, say, André Gide or André Malraux or whoever prestigious, interesting writer of the time, and they did this with some sophistication, and they were not all constantly saying, East, West, what can I do? Mm-hmm. They were living these things peacefully in a very harmonious way, sometimes, of course, feeling the tensions and drama that these civilizations and their best products of these civilizations were giving them. But then they were not considering this East-West, what do I do now kind of thing. So this I told you to undercut your question, to say that, well, actually, yes, I'm also like them, that I don't live with East-West all the time. This is more a journalistic question, but inevitable question too, because it comes from Turkey's geographical and cultural position.
Well, also artistically, though, it's something that comes up over and over again, in Snow, very, very obviously, mm-hmm. but I was thinking about this wonderful line that Black says in My Name is Red, where he says to the other another character, Butterfly, he says, East is East and West is West. And Butterfly responds, an artist should simply paint the way he sees fit rather than troubling
yes,
over East
I
and
agree.
West.
Look, we're talking about literature. The art of the novel is the global form for almost 100 years now. It marginalized poetry. It marginalized drama. It, of course, finished off all the traditional romances, Leyla and Mejnun's are all finished. Aspiring Korean writer or Argentinian writer or an African Arabic, anyone who wants to express himself, herself, is now, and statistics show us, is writing novels, more or less. They are using the same literary form. Here, there is no East-West, that the whole literary world is already globalized and no one is complaining about it because novels have, just like, as I suggested in My Name is Red, portrait painting has a convincing power that you want to use that form, forgetting whether it comes from East and West.
Well, but people would argue that the novel is a distinctly Western creation.
It is.
Creation,
so,
just as in,
you so know, is electricity, you know, yes. But then we use it.
Right. Well, there's this sort of moment that, you know, staying on My Name is Red for a moment, and we're going to open it up to questions in just a second. But, you know, part of the problem with this, of course, is that this notion that the Frankish masters are infecting the distinctly Ottoman, you know, and Persian
art form. Yes, that is
form.
Another issue. That in My Name is Red, I argue about ways of seeing. Now we're talking about the novel as global form, but the post-Renaissance painting was a global form after 16th, 17th century. Everyone began doing paintings like they did using perspective. The visual globalization of the world was achieved when photography invented. Everyone did, and everyone more or less begin to see the world in the same way. But ask yourself, My Name is Red suggests, what if there were other ways of seeing, other ways of representing the visual world? What are the philosophical consequences of this argument? This is the serious, more philosophical aspect of My Name is Red, and I take this point seriously. Yes, you may also add that, well, Orhan, you're saying that the world is globalized literary and we all write novels and forget its consequences. No, you can legitimately ask that. Why do we all write novels? Maybe there are other ways of writing literature. Yes, that is a valid argument, but then we have to see what you do with the new ways of writing.
Let me invite the audience to form on the mics, and as you're doing that, I'll just ask you just very briefly, is there a distinctly Turkish novel? Or is there a distinctly Muslim novel?
Such no,
a
thing there exists. Is no distinctly Muslim novel. There's no distinctly Christian novel. There's no distinctly French novel. Maybe there's a French novel because they invented the novel.
But not a Turkish novel.
No, of course not. That's a wrong way of arguing. That is the dilemma of national literary historians. They have to find a distinctly Turkish novel. They have to find a distinctly Turkish painting. And especially in painting, we all know that Persian, Mughal, Ottoman painting was almost all one. Now that we have national states, all these scholars are inventing the difference,
right.
And which we know that is artificial.
So I'll just go back and forth as long as we have time. Please just state your question very, very briefly, no speechifying, and then...
And don't Mr. argue Papa. With me.
And don't... don't argue. Yes, sir.
My question refers to snow. And your headscarf wearing suicide woman with Egypt being in the limelight today in the niqab, do you have any reflections writing snow? And would you have written anything different today dating 6 years?
No, you know, I don't write my novels responding to developments. I wrote that in a period of my life, inspired by some suicide girls, which Turkish and international newspapers reported about Batman, actually some 200 kilometers, 120 miles south of Kars. And I combined those stories, which were real, with my desire to write about politics of Turkey, nationalism, secularism, military coups, all sorts of Turkish nationalism, Kurdish nationalism, also a way of history, brutal politics, intolerance, and I wanted to make a sort of a microcosmos of Turkey from the little town of Kars. But then so much happening in our lives, how can I change my novels no, I wouldn't write it differently.
Yes, sir.
You got some help here, Orhan Bey. My name is Armen Melikian. I have written a novel which is a continuation of your snow, but it happens.
Well, you don't ask my copyright. You don't ask permission.
I will. It happens on the other side of the border from Kars. My question is actually I contacted some students in Gars trying to see, you know, how much they have imbibed snow, but I didn't get any luck. So since you're here, my question is to you, what was the reality structure in the novel? How much of it was a reality? The reason I'm asking this, I have a very personal interest in this because my anti-hero is the dog that, so one of those dogs that appears with when Najib and Khan meet in the snow. There are some dogs hovering there, and one of those dogs become the embodiment of Najib's soul, which appears on the other side of the border, and the novel continues.
Mm. So, since you're asking me how much of my novel is fantasy, how much of it reality?
Yes,
of course.
What
this is the most popular question a writer is asked. And there are two tendencies. Of course, it's all real, one wants to say. And of course, it's all fantasy, one wants to say too. It's always a combination of these two. But how can I go from detail to detail? This is real. In fact, the joy of reading a novel is heavily based on trying to guess, did he really live this or did he invent this? And it continues endlessly. Convincing, we think, well, he cannot imagine this convincing with this clear and convincing power. He probably lived this. Or if we think that it's implausible, well, we'll say maybe this is his imagination, so forth and so on. There is no end to this question. This question lies at we ask this question because the nature of the novels makes us ask this question.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, you do tease the readers. You show up.
The art of the novel teases the reader, really.
Yes, that's very true.
It's not me. The structure of the novel makes the reader ask this question.
That's absolutely true, and it is a fallacy that we hear a lot. Mm. That said, in Museum of Innocence, Orhan Pamuk is a character. In Snow, Orhan Pamuk is a character.
Yes.
Even in My Name is Red, Orhan
but
is a
he's
character.
He's not a main character. He's just someone summing up the story who has just appearing there. That's not important, really. It's not even a Borgesian or Pirandello-esque appearance. It's just a narrative thing. It's just a little signature that I like, but it's not an important thing about the book. I may not have appeared, and the Museum of Innocence wouldn't be so different, right?
I like it, too. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Hi. They often talk about Muslims in the East getting too westernized, but in the literary world, they don't always talk about Western novelists getting easternized. And I was wondering, in today's like globalized society, are there any either famous novelists in American history, American writers, who you see that deal with themes that
Eastern
you would
themes?
Consider Islamic, actually, like Islamic themes?
Well, I would say that your question is very naive, you know. that who are they? Why do we care about what they say? Looking for cultural influence is sometimes this way, sometimes that way. There is no French invented the novel. The whole French and the British invented the novel. The whole world learned from them. But we don't say, well, now there should be some egalitarian counter movement and this or that. History is a cultural history. Do not look for symmetries like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good evening. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate you naming your heroine as Fosun.
Sorry?
I really appreciate you naming your heroine Fosun, meaning mm-hmm. enchantment, and mm-hmm. it's fantastic. But my question is about a theme that I observed in The Snow, which is my favorite novel of yours. Towards the end of the book, after the National Theater has been taken over and the Islamists have been taken to that school, Ka is taken to the school where he observes the Islamists being tortured, beaten up, and he is appalled. At the same time, I don't remember which character, but somebody from the military asks him, looks at him with a smile, asks him, "You seem surprised. Don't you realize that if we let them be, the first people they come after is people like you?" Now, I'm from Iran, as Mr. Aslan is. I wonder what is the role of intelligence or intelligentsia in a country like Turkey or Iran? How much can we allow the military or the government oppress others who are not like us?
Well, look, I am not a statesman. I am a novelist. If you're asking how much we allow to be people to oppress, zero. That's how I look at it. Once you begin thinking, well, how much we can torture and how much we can allow them do this and how much we restrict freedoms, then you are behaving like a statesman, and that goes to hell and paid with good intentions. I didn't choose to be a statesman, perhaps because I didn't want these questions in my life. I wanted to write novels and identify with people who are repressed along with the repressors too. My job is not to evaluate how much we can repress people, how much we can allow others do this or that. That's not my starting point. My starting point is to understand the problems of human heart, to identify with people who are in good or bad or repressed or repressing, and see the picture truly. This is the last thing I would want to do, ask myself, how much we allow others to be repressed. This is not something I put that I would be willing to explore and understand.
Thank you.
We're going to have time just for two more questions, one from each side, I'm afraid. So, yes, sir.
All these people who are in line should ask. I'll be brief now that they're waiting. Yes.
Promise?
Yes. But then they should be brief, and I'll also be brief.
Very brief. We'll try to get a couple more in.
I was very interested in hearing about the global influence and strength of the novel. And myself being a psychologist, and knowing that in the same time span, psychology has become global, a global force all over, I was wondering if you see any connection between the advent, let's say, of the novel with the advent of psychology.
I don't know too much about psychology. I'm a novelist, I would say, jokingly.
Yes, very good. Yes, sir. Orhan Bey, teşekkür. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for your patience. Thank you very much.
Orhan Pamuk will be signing copies of his new book, The Museum of Innocence, just out that side. So please grab a book, stand in line, and I'm sure he'd be happy to sign it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.